K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to our monthly talk show. My name is Sheila.
My name is Doro.
And I'm Danny.
All right. And this is our monthly show where we discuss a certain product, and then we discuss the social impacts, environmental impacts, health impacts. We just do a deep dive into researching and share what we found out. Just a reminder to everyone, we are not investigative journalists. So, you know, we do get things wrong, and we're
still using the internet.
Yeah,
so you know how that goes.
So we always
would be great to have enough money to fly to New Zealand, Europe, and Ohio to visit the farms that we're talking about. I'd love that. Yes.
Yeah, and this month we have a special, special guest, Cody from the Foggy Bottom Boys in Ferndale.
Yes.
And we invited Cody in to have some local insights about the dairy industry. Super excited about that.
Hey, Cody. Thanks so much for being here today. Would you mind to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me today. I'm Cody Nicholson-Stratton. I'm a sixth-generation dairy farmer in Ferndale. We are known on social media as the Foggy Bottoms Boys, and we also have an ice cream shop in Lolita known as Jersey Scoops, which you can actually find our ice cream in pints all the way down into Southern Humboldt as well. Like I said, we're a sixth-generation farm, and we are pretty traditional in our farming practices. We farm with four generations on the farm today, including my husband and I, my grandfather, my dad, mom, and then our six-year-old son.
You're 6 years old is farming too.
Yeah, he has his own little chores, mostly taking care of his chickens.
Oh, okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
Sounds really beautiful, though. That's really special that you have such an intergenerational farm going
Absolutely.
On.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
And thank you so much for doing that right here in the region where we are.
Yeah, thanks
be
for being
proud
here.
Proud of our region.
Yeah. It's really beautiful.
All right. So in a nutshell, we're just going to review what we said last month. So we shared was that over the last few decades, dairy farmers have been manipulated and crushed by the banks, the dairy corporations, and the co-ops. The sales prices are so low that the government has been making up for the deficits, and the practices they are using have destroyed the mental health of the farmers and the land. That's some of what we touched on.
Yeah, not even to mention the massive propaganda push from the U.S. to have its citizens be drinking milk after World War II. So, Cody, please tell us more about the show, about your production methods, and let's just make it super clear to remind everyone that we're kind of referencing Big Dairy here, and a lot of stuff that we're criticizing is from Big Dairy, and the way that Cody farms is vastly different. So we're really excited to hear his insight about things and to have a nice contrast from all of this negative Big Dairy talk that we're going to be criticizing.
Yeah, so Cody, you told me that you listened to last month's show while you were milking your cows. I love it.
That's great.
So what do you think? Did we exaggerate? Do you have any comments inside in which way what you're doing is totally different than what we were talking about?
Yeah, I thought you guys actually had a really good representation of the dairy industry as it exists right now, particularly the challenges that family farms have when it comes to the control over the market from both cooperatives as well as processors, and that really farmers are struggling from a mental health crisis in this country brought on by the economic burdens that are placed on them, the challenges around being price takers, not price setters. And then, you know, also one thing that I think if you talk to any farmer, they'll tell you is a real challenge can be the regulatory burden. Just that, you know, a lot of farmers enjoy being outside and working, and there's an ever increasing amount of paperwork that goes around with farming that isn't really what you get into agriculture to be part of. You know, how we're different is that we're really would fall into that category that's become kind of popularly known as regenerative agriculture. And our farm, you know, we like to say farms from the grass viewpoint. So we're looking at how we grow the grass, and then what we sell is a product of just being a grass farmer. When we talk about being regenerative, to us, that kind of has three aspects to it. We're renewing or regenerating our rural communities, trying to bring back that vibrancy that was lost when farms consolidated, particularly, you know, when Earl Butz, the Secretary of Ag in the 70s, said, you know, get big or get out to farmers. We're trying to renew the environment. And that is not just the soil and carbon sequestration as part of, you know, our global climate crisis, but also improving biodiversity and wildlife habitat and improved animal welfare. And we really do that through more not farming from a land, an intensive landscape viewpoint, but we take the viewpoint, and this is something that a lot of Humboldt farmers do, is that we try to put our most productive land into intensive farming, mimicking the sort of animal behaviors that we would naturally see in large herds grazing an area and then moving on and letting it rest and regrow and improving biodiversity, and then setting aside our least productive areas for wildlife habitat, wildlife corridors, windbreaks, things that, you know, intuitively, if you're looking at it from a landscape view of just like extracting the most from it, probably isn't going to give you optimum production. But what we find is when we decrease our inputs and farm more within the environmental constraints that we're part of, our decreased inputs actually result in greater economic output for the farm. And that's kind of the third tier for us as regenerative farmers, is that improving and renewing the economics of the farm. Because regardless of how many amazing environmental practices we can implement, if we're not economically viable, we won't be here next year to continue those practices on the landscape. And we are inherently bound by the rules of being part of, you know, economic life in a capitalist society. And so what we're trying to do is utilize all of those practices that bring our community vibrance, help the environment, sequester carbon, and then really bring life back to the farm. And that's something that we have seen over the past several years of this journey we've taken towards self-processing and direct sales and being involved in our community, is that it brings not only value to the work we do personally, but it also brings an economic benefit to our overall farm.
So what you're saying is that farmers don't need to be struggling so much. There are other ways to do it.
There's absolutely other ways to do it. And in many ways for us, we've had the benefit that my family was always somewhat distrustful of the government programs that promised greater efficiency and sometimes claimed, you know, environmental benefits that we find out in hindsight maybe weren't the best, like moving all of your cows into a barn and putting their manure into a lagoon with the claim that that was better for water quality rather than keeping them on pastures and just into the regenerative spectrum, because those were the practices that my grandfather and father were already really implementing.
I'm glad. If I understood, it's like your dad was, so I guess your dad was farming in the 80s?
Yeah, I mean, he's still on the farm. So he was, yeah, you know, 80s and 90s. And so, yeah.
And he made the right decisions then, which makes it easier for you now.
Yes, because
for sure, absolutely. Farmers who've had decided in the 80s or 90s to go like big tractors, consolidation, having like a million acres or whatever that is, now it's really hard to go back. But if you've never gone that way, well, maybe you're fine.
Exactly.
Well, really interesting.
Yeah, definitely have a deep appreciation for your practices.
Yeah, we were all just like aggressively nodding at everything you were saying over here. We're just like, yeah, you try to shut up. But yeah, this is really great. So it's amazing.
Just to have an idea, are you like a rare type of farm around here, or are there many more like you?
I would say that the kind of farms that we have, you know, we're probably the furthest onto the regenerative spectrum, you know, or one of the furthest. You know, there's Alexander Family Farms and others that are implementing many of the same practices. But Humboldt County is pretty unique in that we are essentially 100% pasture-based. Some farms might bring their cows in the winter, but they're going to be spending the bulk of the year grazing in Humboldt County. And with the exception of one dairy, all dairies in Humboldt are certified organic.
Wow.
And that one, yeah, and the one dairy that isn't certified organic is what we consider a conventional dairy, really is still a pasture-based dairy. They just don't find the economic burden of organic certification to be worth it for them. So they've remained conventional just to avoid the additional costs of being a certified organic dairy.
Wow. Well, it's actually really amazing to hear that there's companies that aren't certified organic that are still having amazing practices. And yeah, the quality can still be out there.
And wait, here we are, three people living in Humboldt who didn't know that the entire Humboldt dairy farming is organic. You guys need to promote it more.
Yeah, that's your job now since you live here.
Farmers are notoriously bad about talking about the good things they do.
But well, we're getting the word out.
Yeah,
over
we'll
Kmart
take a moment today.
Today.
Yeah.
Everyone
Thank
take
you.
That in.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm impressed. Amazing to know that. Okay, so let's finish our part about health impact of consuming milk that we didn't have time to finish last month. And remember, we're talking about big milk here, not about Humboldt organic regenerative Cody's
milk. Not the good stuff.
Yes.
So last show, we discussed the benefits of full-fat dairy as opposed to low-fat or skim. And the fatty components of milk depend on the diet and treatment of the animal. For example, milk from grass-fed cows has 92% more omega-3 fatty acid, and low-fat or skim milks lack most healthy fats.
Yes, and we also discussed the fact that an unhealthy gut, people who have leaky gut, this may lead to allergic reactions to milk. This is especially true for people who are gluten intolerant due to milk proteins cross-reacting with the gluten. And we also learned that while it's true people react to the proteins in milk, most sensitivity is a response to lactose, which is the sugar in milk, and that an enzyme lactase needs to be present to digest lactose. But some people don't produce lactose on their own, and some people do. And there are so many varying factors as to why this is so for an individual.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we also discussed studies showing that full-fat dairy lowering the risk of cardiovascular death, which is counterintuitive. So let's repeat. If you eat the fat of the milk, you're actually doing good for your heart.
Yeah, the full fat is beneficial. It's just all the other ways of, you know, all the fat.
The more processed.
Yeah, the more processed. The, yeah.
Yeah, fat-free.
And so dairy consumption is controversial, but for every study that shows the disadvantages of drinking milk, they are the ones that show the benefits.
Yeah, there was a lot of back and forth, for sure. Okay, so that was a recap of where we went last month within our discussion. But back to the big milk industry, okay? So exposure to pesticides is definitely a problem associated with dairy. While pesticide contamination affects water and agricultural lands generally, dairy products have a greater capacity to accumulate these pesticides in higher concentrations due in part to their high fat content.
Pesticides that have long been banned still show up when dairy products are tested, like DDT, which was widely used in the past and now banned as a human carcinogen. It still persists in the environment and can more easily accumulate in animal food products, including dairy.
Also, the largest use of antibiotics worldwide is for livestock. Much of that use is for non-therapeutic purposes, meaning giving antibiotics to your cows every day in prevention and to promote their feed efficiency and animal growth.
And apart from the dire warnings from scientists that agricultural overuse is leading to antibiotic resistance, another problem is that antibiotic residues can persist in milk and other dairy products despite protocols aimed to minimize this.
The resulting low-dose antibiotic exposure can lead to a variety of problems, such as developing antibiotic resistance, allergic reactions, or experiencing side effects of the medications exposed to.
And commercial milk often contains added hormones and residual hormones from lactating cows. Consuming large quantities can disrupt the delicate hormonal balance in humans. Some studies have linked high milk consumption to an increased risk of hormone-related conditions such as acne and early puberty in children.
Milk contains insulin-like growth factor, a hormone that can influence cell growth and has been associated with certain types of cancer, including prostate and breast cancer, when consumed in excess, which can happen in this culture.
So what we're saying here is be careful with the non-organic conventional milk. It's full of antibiotic hormones and other
pesticides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so let's go back now to calcium, because this is the one they always talk about in the advertisement. They say milk has a high calcium content, which is essential for strong bones and teeth and for nerve signaling, muscle contraction, and secretion of some hormones and enzymes.
However, excessive intake can lead to what is known as the calcium paradox. Studies suggest that while moderate calcium consumption is beneficial, excessive intake might not be as beneficial for bone health as once thought. There is data linking higher milk intake with significantly increased risk of bone fractures. And it's actually the same with supplements, too. I think there's a study saying that people who take calcium supplements have higher risk of bone fractures. So,
right. It comes down to, again, what we're saying. It's like moderation, because calcium is so important for us.
Yeah, it's obviously it's not a detrimental thing, but it's the amount.
But it's just in our – if we're overdoing it.
Mm-hmm. You mean I can't eat cheese 5 times a day?
You're still here, Doro. You've been doing it. You're still here.
So there's several other factors that can affect bone health. In fact, it's significant to note that the U.S. – Oh, let's see here. Yes, one reason may be that dairy's high calcium content, which can cause vitamin D dysregulation and disrupt bone homeostasis, but also the high animal protein content of dairy can induce acidosis, which leads the body compensating by leaching calcium then from the bones. Over time, all of this can have a detrimental effect on our bone health.
Yeah, and while several other factors can also affect bone health, it's significant to note that the U.S. has one of the highest rates of hip fractures in the world, actually, despite our high milk intake. So by contrast, in countries like Japan and Peru, where average daily calcium intake is less than a third of the U.S., the incidence of bone fractures are actually quite low.
And while discussing dairy being high in calcium, it's important to be aware of other good sources. You know, if you are not consuming dairy, you know, and for all of us every day that we can consume turnip greens, kale, mustard greens, beet greens, bok choy, okra, nettle, dandelion, basil, Swiss chard, broccoli, fish with bones, etc. There's so many other components in our diet where we're taking in calcium.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's everywhere.
Nettle is coming out soon.
Oh, God. My favorite green.
And you know that 2 tablespoons of dried ground basil have almost the same amount of calcium as a glass of milk.
Yeah.
That's
significant. Significant.
Basil. Go basil. Okay. Let's touch here on the debate between raw and pasteurized milk.
All right, let's get into it.
Okay, so throughout the years, milk's perishable nature kept it close to the farm, quickly consumed as a beverage, if not turned into cheese or butter. And as the Industrial Revolution created an urban culture and larger scale production, it also created problems for those who still wanted their milk. Distant and unsanitary urban dairies only exacerbated the risk of disease such as typhoid fever, scarlet fever, tuberculosis, diphtheria. Those could be transmitted through raw milk.
And pasteurization solved the problem. That was Louis Pasteur, who invented it in 1864. Then a lot of different steps happened, and it finally became in the U.S. a national standard in 1987. Not so long ago,
actually. That was yesterday. Milk pasteurization typically involves heating the milk to either 145 degrees Fahrenheit for 30 minutes, which is known as the vat method, or 161 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds, which is a high temperature short time, followed by a rapid cooling to below 39 degrees Fahrenheit.
And according to the CDC, pasteurization does not significantly change the nutritional value of milk, But numerous scientific studies have shown that raw milk is correlated with decreased rates of asthma, allergies, eczema, ear infections, fever, and respiratory infections. Raw milk also aids in recovery from antibiotic use and provides many gut-healthy probiotics and enzymes.
So who do we believe here, the CDC or all the numerous scientists?
Well, on our show, who do we ask when we don't know who to believe?
We ask Michael Pollan!
Okay, so here's what Michael Pollan said, our favorite investigative journalist, what he said about milk. Raw milk is delicious and nutritious and more risky to drink than pasteurized milk. It also makes much more interesting cheeses because some of the bacteria and enzymes destroyed during pasteurization contribute striking flavors. But producing raw milk safely takes a lot more care, and in recent years there have been several cases of people, especially children, getting sick after consuming raw milk.
Michael Pollan says, why is the government putting its resources into shutting down raw milk producers, a tiny, teeny industry, when there are many more serious threats to food safety on factory farms?
Yeah, in fact, he also stated that the overwhelming majority of illnesses tied to milk and cheese comes from pasteurized products.
Which I think is just really important to stress and to remember, because raw milk gets this wrap of it's like, and that's what's making people sick. Mm-hmm. And it gets, you know, pasteurized products are doing it even more so.
As we've discussed in the show already, the effects.
Yeah. And while Amish dairymen are being raided by the FDA, Jack DeCoster, the notorious Iowa egg producer whose filthy salmonella infected eggs were linked to an outbreak that sickened more than 1,500 people just last year and received a mild warning letter from the FDA. So what's going on here? I don't know. Kind of sounds like some political theater to me.
Yes. And usually when there is political theater, it is because there is lobbying involved. So most likely the milk industry has a lot to do with creating this fear surrounding raw milk. And it's clearly a difficult product to sell on a larger scale because it has a short shelf life. So there has been, you know, they're trying to create mistrust around it.
But that being said, raw milk has bacteria that pasteurized milk doesn't have anymore.
Yes.
And, you know, in this time of this virus, H5N1 spreading from bird to cows, be aware that raw milk may be more risky in that aspect.
Just that, yeah. Yeah. But also, as we were saying before, that we needed lactase to digest lactose, that is in raw milk.
Well, look at that.
I know. So if
Mother's miracle.
Right? So back to that. So it's if lactose is then digested properly, then its prime role is to provide energy. And then it has this prebiotic effect, promoting the growth of all the healthy bacteria we're needing in our gut. And the pasteurization process kills the enzyme lactase, which some of us don't have.
Yeah. So if you don't produce it on your own, you'll have a hard time digesting pasteurized milk.
Okay. Raw milk, good or bad, you guys make your own decision. The choice is yours. Is it dangerous or not? I don't know. But anyway, for example, me, I don't have access to raw milk. Do you guys? Cody, any comments on raw milk? Can people find it in Humboldt?
Yeah, so actually, before I jump onto raw milk, I do want to circle back to the antibiotics real quickly.
Okay. Yeah,
please.
You were on such an amazing roll that your flow was so great, I didn't want to interrupt it. But one thing that is important to know is that in 2017, the FDA actually prohibited the use of antimicrobials as feed additives for animal for food in the United States. So that, while they're used extensively in other countries, within the U.S., it's actually illegal federally to put antimicrobials in your feed unless it's under the supervision of a veterinarian for therapeutic use to treat active infections. And they've actually...
Wait, so what you call antimicrobial, is that what we were calling antibiotics?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, same thing.
Antibiotics, yep, same thing. And so what they've actually... And to take that a step further, just in our antimicrobial stewardship, the FDA, first California did it, then the FDA implemented it. All antibiotics for food animal use are actually by prescription only now. They're not over the counter as they used to be.
Wow, amazing.
We could just go to the feed store. So you actually have to be under the supervision of a veterinarian within the U.S. to utilize antibiotics on any food animal production. That went into effect just a few years ago. And it's a huge step.
That's huge. Go and ahead. Is it being implemented throughout the entire U.S.?
Throughout the entire U.S. It's been implemented.
Major.
And so it's been huge. The one challenge that they have found is that because there is a national shortage of large animal veterinarians, it has become hard for some farms to actually access veterinary care for their livestock. It's still been a great step in antimicrobial resistance prevention within the U.S. Of course, other countries have differing rules that may not be as stringent as ours are now, but that is a great step forward. Now, the raw milk, that is something we get questions about all the time,
people
looking for it. We do not do any raw milk products for a number of reasons. First is that raw milk is not legal in Humboldt County. It's actually prohibited in our county statutes to sell or give raw milk away. There are licensed raw milk dairies in California, but those and most counties allow them. But a dairy that's a raw milk dairy has to be specially licensed by the state and has very stringent testing requirements for the safety of their product. For me, you know, we don't drink raw milk on our farm. I also don't drink or use like raw juices. We pasteurize everything just on the stovetop if we're going to do that. Just because there is always the risk of, you know, salmonella, campylobacter, and things that like tuberculosis and that have kind of gone out that were once transmitted through milk. And I kind of look for us, the way we always look at raw milk is that it's sort of like wearing your seatbelt. We know that we can not wear our seatbelt in the car and always, you know, nothing could happen and we could be fine and we could get in a car accident wearing our seatbelt and be injured. But without those guardrails in place, we could also, you know, not wear a seatbelt and get in an accident and then have a much more tragic outcome. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that for us, we don't feel is worth the risk. We definitely are very stringent about our cleanliness on the farm, but cows are cows and they do cow things in the barn, which is often creating manure. So there's always the risk of something happening that is just outside of our control, and having that safety net of pasteurization in place is one more step to provide a safe, healthful product for our consumers.
Awesome. I love that. It's a great perspective.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. For the benefits, like you said, there's always that risk involved too. So,
But everyone should do what's best for their family. That's where we come down to. Everyone can make their own choices.
Yes.
Totally. The choice is yours. And that is what you are tuned into now. You're listening to
well,
The Choice is Yours.
Not really, because there's no access to raw milk.
Well,
at least in Humboldt.
Unless you get your own cow or goat.
Yeah, unless exactly. If you have your cow or goat at home and you're doing it yourself.
Okay.
I could have sworn I saw, you know, somewhere up in the cute little mountains of Arcata somewhere that they had some raw milk going around. I don't know. I feel like there's probably the underground market
there's
for
like
that.
There's like an underground market.
Yeah. For sure.
Okay.
So. We're not calling anybody out. But if you're looking for raw milk, I think you could probably find it.
Okay. Yeah.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Yeah, and you're listening to The Choice is Yours with Danny,
Doro,
and Sheila, and
Cody from the Foggy Bottom Boys. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here.
Time is flying because we're just having such a good time here.
I know. We're going to make this a four-hour episode this morning because we just don't want to cut it off. But let's get into A2 milk. That's an interesting topic I didn't know much about before starting this.
So have you seen in the store the A2 milk? I've wondered, like, what is this? I found the answer on a podcast that I love, which is called Gastropod. It's looking at food through the lens of science and history. I totally recommend it if you are a food freak like me, Gastropod. So here is what we learned.
All right. So in milk, the main protein is something called casein. There's about 2 teaspoons in every quart of milk, and most of that is made up of a subtype of casein called beta casein.
And some time ago, probably a few thousand years ago, there was a totally normal random genetic mutation in a cow that led to produce A1 beta casein rather than A2. Yes, A2 came before A1. I know it's kind of confusing, but it's how the cookie crumbled there. These types of tiny mutations happen all the time. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a big deal, but even when it's not an evolutionary advantage or a disadvantage, it might just stick around. And it seems like that was the case here.
So where it gets super intriguing is that most of the cows that are raised industrially today are breeds like Holstein and Friesian, and they have this A2 mutation. The A1 mutation. Meanwhile, the traditional Indian or African breeds of cattle, they still produce the A2 milk.
Yeah, and to make it more confusing, some heritage-type breeds like Jersey, Guernsey, or Brown Swiss, their milk typically has a bit of both, but they tend to produce more A2 than A1 in varying proportions. Now, scientists don't seem to know why the breeds that tend to be used in industrial farming tend to be A1 cows. It seems to just be how it played out.
And apparently, A2 is better for people who have a hard time digesting milk. This older version seems easier on the gut.
Dennis Savianois, the Emeritus Professor of Nutrition at Purdue University, he and his team had a study and they were trying to find out if this was true. They had four different types of milk with different levels of A2 or A1 proteins and one that was also lactose free. And the milk doses were adjusted for the body weight of the study participant.
They found pretty conclusively that overall people who drank 100% A2 milk had significantly fewer stomach upsets and less pain than they did after drinking conventional A1 milk.
But here's the thing, A2 milk didn't help everyone, and that's because there's something else going on, but scientists don't know what it is yet.
Huh.
And if you want to try the A2 milk, you can. It's in stores, you can get it, and it tastes identical to regular milk. It's just a little more expensive. Because when farmers have to make a herd that's completely A2, you have to certify that it's A2 on there and there's additional costs.
Dennis Savinois said that now we know about this A1 mutation, we might end up just removing it from the food system and only having cows that produce the A2 variety. One day, all milk might be A2 milk again, like it was many thousands of years ago. I think you're going to come to that we're going to come to a point where the consumer will just say, why take the chance with A1 when we can buy A2? And maybe the dairy industry is going to respond to that with herds that are essentially all A2. Who knows?
In America, only about 25% of people can't digest milk well. But so A2 won't help all of them. So that's even less than 25%. And in the entire world, it's more than half, nearly 70% of the people have a difficult time digesting the milk.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah, so I guess we'll see what happens, but it would be a big deal if farmers made the switch from the Holstein to the more rustic cows. Is it Holstein? Did we decide? Holstein?
Cody?
It's Holstein.
Holstein.
Holstein. Okay, thank you.
So the Holstein dairy cattle dominate this country's milk production. They're the black and white ones, super cute, the most popular ones.
Yeah, and the reason for their popularity is clear.
I said it both ways. So I screwed us all.
They're known for their high milk production. They're easy to handle. They are resistant to stress, which means more profit for the dairy producer.
I just want to say that to me, Holstein are not the cutest.
Really?
Yeah, sorry.
All flashed before my eyes when I said that because I felt like I was like, no, but the brown ones. Like, no,
yes,
it's true.
The brown and white ones.
No, I just want to hug. I just want to hug them all.
I do love cows very much.
Okay, the problem with Holstein is that their milk is A1. Too bad. So I don't want to get too much into it, but different breeds of cows have different characteristics. Some of them are cuter than others. But also, and more importantly, they don't treat the pasture the same way. They don't eat the same grasses. They are more or less hardy. They are more or less adapted to a special terroir. Like, okay, I'm going to be French here in France. You know, we have 365, I think, type of cheeses. And this is because different types of cows are in different terroirs, so their milk has a different taste, so it gives a different cheese. Okay, wow. In the States, we are far from that because Holstein is everywhere. And all the cheese have the same taste. Cody, what do you think? What breed of cows do you have?
Well, we actually raise the cutest of all the breeds of cows.
I like that. And the happiest.
which are the Jerseys, the Jersey. Little brown cows. They originated on the island of Jersey. They're renowned for high butter fat and being excellent grazers. So they are cows that are very well adapted to pasture-based systems. They used to be very popular when Americans consumed more butter than fluid milk, and then they lost popularity. But my family, for 160 years, has raised them here on the North Coast. Wow. And our herd is, in fact, an A2 herd, where, as you stated, with the cost of certification, we don't pay for the certification, but we have done the testing, and we have A2 cows. Largely because we use artificial insemination on most of our mature cows, and we have used semen imported from bulls from Denmark, which are higher butter fat, well adapted to kind of our climate and grazing systems and our style of farming.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, Jersey is an island between France and England, and so I would not be surprised that the climate, therefore the grass there, is very similar to here.
Yes, they are well, it will be pouring rain here, and they are out, not in the barns, they are out eating grass. They do not mind.
Totally adapted to that climate. That's so cool. We are starting only now talking about the environmental aspect of the dairy industry, and that is a huge one, obviously.
Obviously, and everyone, this is a three-parter show. So whatever we don't get to today, we're going to get to it. So we're going to talk about the impacts on the environment from the dairy industry.
The dairy industry is one of the largest food-related contributors to climate change. In fact, dairy comes in second only after meat in terms of producing greenhouse gas emission. Dairy is estimated to represent about 20% of the emissions from food production worldwide.
Now we need to talk about the impacts of manure, because the more cows we have, the more manure we have to deal with. And storing liquid manure in tanks results in the emission of greenhouse gases. The emission of greenhouse gases through human processes are the main factor causing climate change. Methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, meaning that its potential to increase global temperatures is much higher than, for example, carbon dioxide.
But farmers can actually sell the methane captured from the animal manure through a process that is called anaerobic digestion, where the methane is collected and sold as renewable energy source. That seems like a great idea. Essentially, turning waste into valuable commodity. This is particularly prevalent in states like California, with strict greenhouse gas regulation that incentivize methane capture from farm through carbon credit programs.
But it is essentially rewarding the biggest and most polluting industrial hog and dairy operations, allowing them to become even bigger and make more profit.
So, Cody, you were telling me that about the SB1383, which aims at reducing the greenhouse gas emission from livestock and dairy in California through managing the manure better. Please, tell us more.
Oh, absolutely. So I love SB 1383. This was a Senate bill that aims to reduce our manure methane emissions within the dairy sector. It also applies to landfills and green waste in municipalities, but by 40% by 2030. And the dairy industry is the only sector that's in California that's actually on track to reach that, which, you know, is a little bit of California exceptionalism here. We are really leading the world in this effort, in that California went with the carrot rather than the stick approach to this. And so what the legislature did was they made California's dairy farmers partners in addressing the climate crisis. So they incentivized digesters was one of the pathways that there were grants available, but they also implemented other projects like shifting away from flush systems that create lagoons to systems that collect the manure so that it can be composted and used for crop fertilization, They helped farms, or and currently still are helping farms, set up composting systems, these really cool little autonomous robots that run around some barns and vacuum up the manure and then go deposit it so it's not being flushed, but it's being picked up and composted.
What a sight to imagine.
Yes, it's a very, it's wild.
That is wild.
They've also done composting pack barns, which several farms on the North Coast have, so that the cows are actually staying on top of their manure gets composted, and the cows are using that as bedding, which generates heat underneath them during winter. And they're incentivizing farms, putting cows on pasture, and the cows spending more time on pasture. And so all of these are ways to get manure out of an anaerobic environment and really reduce the methane emissions while avoiding leakage, which is kind of the Senate or the legislature's way of saying keeping the dairies in California rather than some of those large dairies just picking up and moving to states that don't regulate, like Texas, Idaho, or Oklahoma. Because as we know, like the NIMBYism doesn't really work when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. If they're just moving elsewhere and releasing the same amount of GHGs, that doesn't change our global situation. And so this was a way of really creating a partnership and promoting reductions and a good approach to greenhouse gases.
I love all this good news you're bringing us. It's really making me feel a little better about the state of the world right now.
Wait, I want to see if I understood right. So when a cow is taking a crap in the pasture, it doesn't make methane. It has to
go.
Right.
Right, because so if a cow produces manure in the pasture, that is going to break down and go into the soil, and that actually promotes soil carbon sequestration, so pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, because it's not going into an anaerobic environment. What happens when you have those cows in a barn and you flush it out with water and it goes into these giant lagoons, that creates a environment where there's not oxygen, and that's where the methanogens really thrive and mm-hmm. produce methane. Mm-hmm. So okay. The idea is to prevent it from ending up in a liquid system.
So really everything you're saying today, it's like the biggest problem with the milk industry is to have those cows, too many of them in a too small space, so that you need to give them antibiotics, you need to give them feed, you need to, and the manure is making methane, but if they're outside grazing, they're totally fine. They're actually good for the planet.
Yes. So the way we manage them really changes how they impact the environment. We know no matter what we do, we have an impact on the environment, but the cows can be a tool to improve the environment and to help us as we face the climate crisis.
Well, thank you so much for your work to do. Yeah. It really is so inspiring, and in that you're right at the forefront of this, you know, and the shifts that you're making, that your family has provided as farmers is just huge. And I think really important for everyone to be hearing today.
Yeah. Okay.
So we'll just keep talking about manure until someone wants to call and chime in. And let's see, it does contain a handful of primary contaminants that impact our water quality, such as nitrogen, phosphorus, bacteria, and other pathogens, and organic matter.
So land spreading of manure. So you understand that we are not talking about a cow being in a field.
In the pasture, mm-hmm.
In the pasture. Mm-hmm. We're talking about putting all the manure together because they spend too much time, too many cows together in a stable, you call that?
Yeah, barn, stable,
in a barn,
sure.
And then you go to the land to spread it with the big tractor. This is a notable source of concerning microorganism into water from where they can reach animals, humans, and they may create infection. To avoid that, the manures need to be composted, like we said, but it is not always done properly, and those pathogens always leach in the well, not always, but often, in the wells and in the water waves, producing the famous algae bloom that is so common in the summer.
Yes, a new report from the environmental watchdog group Food and Water Watch suggests that almost 2 million fish were killed from manure spills in Iowa between 2013 and 2023. So over a decade, 2 million fish were killed.
Manure spills in the state of Iowa have contributed to what environmental advocacy group call a water quality crisis. And actually in the capital, in Des Moines, the local water supply has one of the world's largest nitrate removal facility. The nitrate is the resulting chemical of manure that is not absorbed by the soil or the crop.
And due to high levels of nitrate in water, which can cause the blue baby syndrome in children and colon cancer in adults, the Des Moines Water Works has to run its nitrate removal system more frequently as the situation worsens, at a cost of anywhere from $10,000 to $16,000 per day, which falls entirely on utility customers. Wow.
So again, thank you, Cody, for doing it differently.
Thank you.
Here where we live. Thank you.
And so let's move on to the water and the feed, which are also huge aspects, right? And we found a lot of different numbers, but the WWF says, do you know what that is, Dora?
Yes, the World Wildlife Foundation.
Right. Yes, the Wildlife Foundation says that to produce 1 gallon of milk in the U.S., it needs 144 gallons of water. That's a lot of water, especially in places with water shortages, right? More than 93% of that water is used to grow feed for dairy cattle. So let's talk a little bit more about their food.
Yeah, so the average cow eats 2% of their body weight a day, and they are very heavy, so that makes it 24 to 26 pounds of food each day. That's a lot of food.
And a cow's natural diet consists mainly of grasses, legumes, alfalfa, clover, and hay. They are grazing animals, and many cows also enjoy fruits as delicious snacks.
Oh, yeah, apples.
FYI. Apples.
Okay, but the vast majority of cows, like we've been saying in the States, they live in factory farms. And those factory farms, they depend on cheap, unsustainable animal feed, such as corn and soy, to maximize profits at the expense of the animal welfare.
In 2019, dairy cow feed consisted of 39% corn, 16% dried distiller grains, and 13% soybeans. While dairy cows are given some hay and grass, it makes up a smaller percentage.
So what can we say about corn? There's so much. We actually had a full show about corn a few years ago, and we could barely cover everything.
Yeah.
It's the easiest, you know, they say, to feed cattle. That's in a lot of the feed. It's cheap. Consequently, meat has become affordable for the average American household, which has subsequently increased the demand for meat then and the amount of beef produced in feedlots.
But as we said, cows are grazers, so why are we giving them corn?
Right.
Good question. cattle have complex digestive systems, which allow them to digest cellulose found in grass. The addition of corn to the diet changes the chemistry of its digestive system and leads to serious illnesses, including bloat and acidosis. This illness, which is extremely painful for cattle, no, we don't like that, brings into question the ethics of feeding cattle a corn-based diet and the ethics of the policies surrounding corn production.
Also, cows only get E. coli if they eat corn. Grass-fed cows just don't have it. If cows are fed grass for a week before slaughter, that would actually be enough to leave the E. coli out of their system. But the meatpacking industry doesn't even want to do that. They'd rather irradiate the meat than go to the trouble of feeding cows grass. Okay, another thing about corn is that corn is the most commonly grown crop in the States, and most of it is GMO, genetically modified. Most GMO corn is created to resist these insects, to resist to pests, but also to tolerate the herbicide like glyphosate, for example, Roundup. So, well, the farmer may be putting more Roundup than needed on their crop since it kills everything but the corn, thus killing more biodiversity than non-GMO counterparts.
Okay. And what do you think? I mean, because we're nearing the end here. Should we keep discussing now moving on to soybeans, or should we let Cody have?
Yeah.
I'd rather. I want to hear from.
Next
yeah, exactly, yes, Cody. We want to hear more from you. So jump in here.
Well, so I would say one thing that comes to mind when we're talking about the diet of cows. California is somewhat unique. And this is relating more to like our large scale dairies in the Central Valley. I had the opportunity to tour a few of them last year, and that's certainly not how we raise cows and not how we want to raise cattle. But one thing that I did find really fascinating was that they, because crop production is so prevalent in our state, the dairies actually upcycle a lot of the crop waste that would otherwise end up in landfills, like almond hulls and orange pulp. Mm-hmm. And those are fed to the dairy cows as part of a balanced, like a ration balancing diet. And so rather than that ending up in a landfill, they upcycle it through the dairy cattle into milk and cheese and different dairy products, which was a very fascinating aspect of California that I had not seen.
You know what? Because naturally, would the cow eat almond or oranges?
I mean, if they had access to them, our cows will eat most anything they find that they can get a hold of. Ours would be quite happy to eat an orange if I set it out there for them. that was an interesting thing that I hadn't experienced before, witnessed. And then, the other part was that a lot of those dairies produce the compost that's used in organic crop production. And so it was when you're looking at the California farms, which is very different from the rest of the country, because we have so much crop production, it was fascinating to see how interwoven those are, the crop production side and organic crop production and those large dairies in the Central Valley. But when we're coming up here to Humboldt County, most of the manure produced on our farm stays on the farms. It's actually almost a precious commodity because we're fertilizing our pastures and we want to keep it on our farms.
Right.
And then, we perform routine soil testing. So we're able to make sure that we're not over applying manure, which we never are, but it's a way to monitor our application rates and to check our soil health and really actually touch base with metrics. So that's a part of the Humboldt system that's very different.
Oh, amazing. You guys are using metrics as well, just like on the cannabis farms?
So we're using soil sampling and soil testing. And that goes even further. When we're soil testing, we're not just looking for like the nitrogen and phosphorus, but we're actually looking for the organic life that's in the soil. So we're testing for nematode species diversity to see are our soils genuinely healthy. Like, it's not just about are we set to grow a lot of grass, but are we actually providing and good ecology for the life below the soil surface.
I can hear that you're a very positive person, and I love that, but most of us have never gone to a feedlot. So would you please tell us just how is it to actually see them? Because I've seen them on documentaries, all those cows stacked up together, no grass at all. But tell us your feeling about that.
It's very different. So when you're talking about a beef feedlot, for example, one important thing to know is those cows are there for like the last 60 days. So they've been on pasture up until they're being finished on grain. Personally, I do not enjoy the taste of grain-fed finished beef. I am a fan of grass-fed beef, and that's what, in addition to our dairy, we raise grass-finished beef. There's definitely different challenges to it. I think that the best system, from my viewpoint and where we are, is definitely to have cattle on pasture. They bring a lot to the environment. They're serving in critical roles. And that's a system that is well suited to sustainably producing food. And so that is definitely how we want to farm and produce it. Our points that I think are interesting and that definitely, we could see the positive viewpoints while they're not all the way across the whole industry. There are contributions that are made. I think if we can continue to move in a positive direction that's more environmentally conscious and aware, that's where we need to keep pushing.
Well, Cody, thank you so much for joining us.
Do you want to tell us your website and where people can find product?
Yeah. So you can find us on Foggy Bottoms Boys on both Facebook and Instagram. And our website is foggybottomsboys.com. And you can find us in basically every local retailer, with the exception of Safeway, nice. In the dairy aisle, ice cream is Jersey Scoops. And that's made with whole milk produced right here on our farm and then processed in our little micro creamery in Lolita.
Beautiful. Fantastic. Well, thank you for giving us all an amazing, healthy treat and amazing food from your hard work. We all really appreciate it.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.